Welcome to All Sides with Anna Staver. It's a challenge to find men and women willing to serve in the U.S. military. Prospective recruits must meet physical standards, pass academic tests, refrain from psychiatric meds that treat common issues like depression and ADHD, and abstain from recreational marijuana, even if it's legal in their state. The current political climate isn't helping either. Each of the service branches, except for the Marine Corps, missed their 2023 recruiting goals, and the Army fell short for 2 years in a row. The good news is Army recruiters reached their 2024 goal this year. The not-so-good news is that goal was reduced from previous years. We're talking this hour about recruiting challenges and the future of our fighting forces. Washington Post reporter Missy Ryan covers national defense and security issues. She recently wrote an article about the Army's recruiting challenges in particular. It was titled "Selling America: The Army's Fight to Find Recruits in a Mistrustful, Divided Nation." Welcome to All Sides, Missy. Oh, it looks like we're having a little trouble getting Missy on the line. Her story focused on a New Jersey recruiting station this summer and the hunt to find willing recruits. What she found was an array of political, social, and economic challenges, making finding new enlistees hard. And we also want to hear from you this hour while we're getting Missy on the air. If you served in the U.S. military, we'd love to hear why. If you thought about it and ultimately decided you didn't want to join, we'd also love to know why. If your children are considering military service, we'd like you to give us a call at 614-292-8513, or you can email allsides@wosu.org. Again, it's 614-292-8513, or allsides@wosu.org. It looks like we're still trying to get Missy on the line. And one of the things that really struck me about her article, and the reason that I wanted to do a show about military recruiting, is that there wasn't one thing that was going wrong for military recruiters. Some of it is a decline in trust of institutions. You look at any polling data, right, from Congress to the U.S. Supreme Court to the military to our commander-in-chief to media. Trust in institutions is declining, and that makes it harder to sell people on the idea of stepping up to defend America. There's also a job shortage, and companies are offering better pay, better wages. There's also been an increase in depression amongst young adults since the pandemic. And that means treatment for those is not allowed, and people have to be off antidepressants for a certain period of time before we can serve in the military. All of this is a confluence of issues that is making it harder to find people willing to serve. It sounds like we may have Missy Ryan on the phone now. Are you there, Missy?
I'm here. Thank you very much.
Oh, thank you. That is Missy Ryan. She's a Washington Post reporter who covers national defense and security issues. So I was kind of running through a little bit of your article, but you focused on one group of recruiters based on the Jersey Shore. Can you tell me a little bit about them and what they had been, how they'd been struggling to hit their recruitment numbers?
Sure. So a colleague and I spent about a month kind of immersed in the recruiting mission of this one Army recruiting station in Toms River, New Jersey, which is down on the Jersey Shore. And we kind of lived the ups and downs of this group of about six enlisted NCOs who were tasked with meeting a certain target. And that sort of is reflective of the kind of setup and the kind of monthly mission that recruiting stations have all over the country. And these soldiers are really on the hook for finding and putting in the Army a certain number of people every month. And it's a pretty nerve-wracking mission for them just because of some of the things that you just mentioned. There's a smaller and smaller share of people in the age group, 17 to 24, that meets the Army's standards. That's only about 23% now meet the physical, moral, and educational standards. And that ranges from challenges that, you know, the recruiters are seeing in shifts across the U.S. society in terms of body composition and obesity. It has to do with people being able to meet the educational standards. There's a test that everybody has to take in order to get into the military, and there's, you know, a lot of people, especially after the pandemic, who are unable to reach the minimum that they need. And then there are things like making sure that people can meet the standards related to drugs, and that would be, you know, just marijuana is one example, which is now legal in more than half of American states, but is not allowed for the military. And then some of the medical drugs that people are taking for anxiety and depression and ADHD, which are very widely prescribed now, but as you were saying, are not permitted for people who are entering the military. And so this kind of comes, oh, and then there's also the challenge of people having just less confidence and interest and familiarity with the military. You know, the public approval ratings of the military are now at their lowest level since the late 90s. You don't have the pull of like a 9/11 event that really encouraged a lot of people to join the military. And so, you know, these recruiters are facing this confluence of challenges when it comes to finding people who have the interest and the ability to serve.
Yeah, I think what was really fascinating about your article too is to combat this, different branches of the military, including the army, have created kind of a pre-boot camp to get people up to those standards, whether they're falling short on the physical standards or the academic tests, or in particular, knowing English well enough to serve.
Yeah, that's actually a challenge. The last thing you mentioned was a particular challenge in the area that we were reporting in. Toms River has, you know, a large population of people who were born outside the United States, particularly from Latin America, and so you have challenges of people meeting the minimum language requirements. That and then other challenges related to the test scores and the body composition and physical requirements is one reason that the Army has opened what they're calling Future Soldier Prep. And those are different kinds of courses that are offered for people who can go down and spend a number of weeks kind of doing intensive either academic training for the entrance exam, or kind of a pre-boot camp in order to get their body in shape and meet the body standards that the military has. And that actually has worked very well. I think we'll probably see that rolled out for some of the only for some of the other services. It's important for your listeners to know that it's not just the Army. The Army is the biggest service, and they need to recruit and enlist the most number of the largest number of people each year. But the military recruiting crisis is not limited to the Army. The Marine Corps has always had an easier job. You know, don't have the same kind of struggles, but the Air Force, the Navy have also struggled to meet their recruiting goals. And it's just a reflection of those kind of societal ch changes that we were talking about, interest and aptitude for serving.
Yeah, when it comes down to English language learners, it's people on the path to citizenship, people with permanent residency. And what's interesting is it seems like, or at least from your reporting, the military and the army in particular is going back and forth on whether it wants to keep these kinds of pre-boot camp programs, whether they want to expand them, whether they want to pull them back. I mean, it seems to be working, right? Giving kids a couple of weeks to get in better physical shape, to meet those academic criteria. Why is there debate over whether to expand these kinds of programs?
Well, I think there's an intent to expand the general future soldier prep, which is kind of one is the physical kind of boot camp and one is the academic boot camp. Where there's more debate is what to do about the English language learners. You know, we met a number of people who wanted to join the military, some of them who were born in the United States but grew up, for example, in Mexico and didn't have the language skills in order to meet the minimum in the entrance exam. And the military, the Army does have a program that can help people with that particular problem with their language skills, but it's not easy to access. And it's not offered as part of that broader Future Soldier Prep program that we were just talking about. And there's debate in terms of, you know, American demographics are changing? Do we need to kind of make a more concerted and official effort to reach those people? Or is it, other people have the view of, well, if these people really wanted to join the army, then they could, do more on their own to improve their language skills such that they can actually pass this entrance exam. So, I think that that is something that is not resolved, but presumably will continue to be a challenge just given the demographics of the United States and the way that our society is evolving.
I want to talk a little bit about marijuana because Ohio became, I believe, the 24th, 25th state in the nation to legalize marijuana just last year for recreational use. It is legal in dozens more states for medical use, but the military still says if you have it in your system for any reason, whether it be medical or recreational, even if it's legal, you cannot serve.
That's right. And it's what the military leaders will tell us is that that's a federal law. They can't change that on
No,
their
yeah.
own until Congress acts. But it's true that it's a huge challenge because, you have these norms changing across American society, but they haven't sort of caught up with the standards. And so there's this real tension between, the way young people live and what they need to do, and that sort of the rubber hits the road for these recruiters who have to, test people before they send them off to the official testing to make sure that everybody's not wasting their time, but also remind people when they're kind of going through the recruiting pipeline, please don't mess this up. Please don't, you need to remember that you're going to be drug tested again and again, and that sort of is in tension with the widespread availability and the laws surrounding marijuana.
Yeah, in your article, you had one candidate who looked promising to these recruiters who then smoked marijuana at a party and would have to wait an additional 90 days to make sure the THC was out of his
Right.
system before he could go forward.
Yeah, and the military is trying to give people, more than one chance because they're grappling with the availability issue. But they're saying, there's only so much we can do. Maybe at some point the military will have to rethink that. People are allowed to drink alcohol and smoke cigarettes and join the military. Maybe at some point that will change, but they're not there yet.
No. The other thing I found interesting is that you have to wait for medical waivers for certain conditions. Like asthma, I get just wanting to make sure that they could do the physical things, but ADHD and the medication for ADHD and requiring that they stop it felt interesting to me. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that.
It is interesting, and again, this is one of these things where the way Americans live and the sort of societal practices and norms have changed, and the military is kind of trying to figure out how they catch up and what standards they change and what standards they don't change. So they have changed, they have sort of evolved and shortened the number of years you have to be off a certain kinds of drugs like ADHD and depression and anxiety medication before you're eligible to join. And they do provide waivers, but that process is very onerous and takes a long time. And the challenge that the recruiters face is that people drop out of the pipeline. If it's going to take an 18-year-old who's just graduating college and doesn't really know what they want to do, maybe they think they want to join the military, but then if it's going to take a year for them to join, they might find something else that they want to do, or they might decide that actually they don't really want to do it. So kind of there's a question of time and efficiency and striking while the iron's hot that all of these people face. The irony with drugs for ADHD and anxiety is that they can be prescribed to people by military doctors once they're in the military, but just not beforehand. And
Oh,
the
that's weird.
rationale there, it is very weird. But the rationale there is that what, people will say is that, look, this lifestyle is not for everybody. This is a very challenging lifestyle. You are asked to pick up and go all over the world with no notice. You have, a very rigorous, demanding daily existence. You have to be able to subject yourself to danger. And, we want to make sure that there are people that everyone is here is able to withstand that and cope with that and flourish. And so, I think that you can see where people are trying to calibrate that in the right way. And sometimes that doesn't feel for the people who are trying to get people in the military, it doesn't always feel like it's actually calibrated correctly yet.
The other thing is just the labor market. Obviously, everyone who's driven probably around anywhere in this country has seen those signs, you know, signing bonuses, $15 an hour starting pay, $18 an hour starting pay. Like, we're hiring now. So they're also just competing with a market for the last couple of years where employers were offering more money, more benefit, more incentives.
That's right. And the military used to kind of be the only organization that would offer people things like college pay, you know, the GI Bill and the kind of housing and especially educational benefits that that weren't commonly offered in the private sector. But now you have companies like Walmart or Starbucks or even, you know, McDonald's that will help people with that kind of tuition. And so that has kind of eroded the comparative advantage that the military has. And so they're trying to find other ways to incentivize people, you know, and there are a lot of things, you know, there are a lot of benefits that you get still, like help with, you know, buying houses. You know, you see people who have been in, you know, in the NCO ranks who have bought multiple homes. It can be a real vehicle for sort of financial stability for a lot of people, but you have to first get them to walk through the door and actually sign on the dotted line. And so that competition, I think, and the sort of structural changes in the job market are things that the military is grappling with as well.
You know what made me feel really old is you wrote that almost all candidates now for military recruitment were born after the 9/11 attacks. And that they don't remember it. They didn't live through it. They didn't feel that surge of patriotism after it. It's something that happened in history. And as somebody, you know, who was in college when it happened, I was like, oh, my goodness, that just made me feel old.
Yeah, well, I mean, it actually is a very big deal because, you know, there was obviously a big surge in people signing up for the military after 9/11, you know, the surge in patriotism and feeling that people wanted to contribute or protect America or whatever it was. And that is, there's no event that like that right now. And obviously, you know, nobody wants the country to be attacked, but it is, there is a function, there is a sort of cause and effect thing that is not in play right now. And, you know, the United States doesn't face any sort of imminent external threat, and that's good. But at the same time, it's kind of, it's harder to focus people on this opportunity at that moment. And, you know, and then on top of that, there's this sort of question of erosion of trust in public institutions. And you see the military has always been one of the highest rated public institutions in terms of how people feel about what the level of confidence is. So compared to, you know, Congress or the media, people always have been very positive on the military. But that has eroded over time. And as I was saying earlier, it's now at the lowest level since the late 90s. And I think that that has to do, and we heard a lot about that when we were reporting, you know, people would say, oh, you know, I don't want my son to join this, you know, politicized military, like the woke military. You know, there's kind of on both sides, there are the sense of polarization and a division within the country is also reflected to some extent in the way people feel about the military, and that's going to be another challenge.
That was Washington Post reporter Missy Ryan. She covers national defense and security. Thank you so much for your time this morning.
Thank you.
Coming up, we're talking with a local Army recruiter about enlistment efforts in the Buckeye State. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's type.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. It's a challenge to find men and women willing to serve in the military. about 60% of Americans say they have a great deal of confidence in the military. And that may seem like a good number, especially when you look at the approval ratings for Congress or the Supreme Court. But it is the lowest percentage of approval since 1997. Some of the challenges in recruitment are longstanding, and some have come up in recent years, like the COVID-19 pandemic. Joining us now is Sergeant First Class Peter Van Dyne. He's a Columbus native and serves as a recruiter in the Columbus West Recruiting Station. Van Dyne was also honored recently at the Pentagon as one of a top 13 Army recruiters in the country and the number one recruiter in his brigade. Welcome to All Sides, Sergeant.
Thank you for having me.
And man, those are some good numbers. Top 13 in the country. That's impressive. Congratulations.
Thank you.
So I want to talk a little bit about what life is like for you as a recruiter here in Columbus. You're a Columbus native. You went to school here. How do you find people willing to serve? What criteria are you looking for? How do you find people?
We use a variety of different ways to find applicants to try to enlist into the Army. We go to high schools. We go to high school games. We go to college games. We volunteer. We go to rec centers. I think it's more just the climate of where you live and where you're around. You just got to get out and get into the community.
Yeah. One of the things in the Washington Post article that struck me is that only a quarter of potential recruits can meet those physical standards, those certain military standards. Have you noticed that it's getting harder to find people who can meet, say, the physical standards to join?
I don't think it's necessarily the physical standards. I think it's more of a, you know, talking to people about how basic training is, how they can make it, how I think people are mentally telling themselves they can't do it.
Mm. And they think it's like a Navy SEAL tryout when it's not?
Yes, 100%. Yes.
Yeah. You know, the COVID-19 pandemic really impacted education, right? Kids were home for sometimes a year at a time. Zoom school worked for some, but not for others. Have you noticed any academic challenges in recruits as a result of the pandemic?
I don't think it's the pandemic. I think it's just more studying, you know, going to school, taking it seriously. You have to study for the ASVAB. It's definitely a hard test.
Yeah, that's the military entrance exam. I think it stands for the Armed Services Vocational Aptitude Battery. Whew. So what does that entail? What's a passing score? What would somebody interested in joining the military have to do to study?
The ASVAB by itself, you know, it's got a lot of different sections. I think the ones that we probably struggle with the most is like your math knowledge, your algebra. I would say for international students, it's more like the vocabulary, word knowledge, paragraph comprehension. If you take school seriously and you study, I know us as recruiters, we give study materials and we try to help people pass. But of course, we're not taking the test, so
no.
It's more just we prepare you for it. And
is it kind of like the SAT?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, very similar.
Okay, so, and you have to get a certain score for the military to say, hey, you know enough math, you know enough vocabulary, you're good to go.
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
And you can take it again if you fail, but there is a limited number of times that you can try again.
Yes, ma'am. Typically, you take the test. If you don't pass the first time, you have to wait 30 days. If you fail again, it's another 30 days. If you fail again, it's 6 months, and so forth and so forth.
I think that's just sort of a recognition that you might need more time spent studying.
Yes, yes. Studying's very important.
You know, the Post article said that recruiters look for prospects, maybe who are in their early 20s, who are in retail jobs, high school athletes, teens decked out in patriotic gear. What do you look for in recruits?
I mean, I look for anyone that wants to serve their country. I think it's just really the person that wants to serve and how you talk about the military, you talk about the benefits. For me, I try to use my experiences, and I was a high school kid that didn't want to join the military. So for me, it came down to, you know, you may not want to join it now, but, you know, we can plant the seed for something that could help you down the line. And I think sometimes when you're talking to high school kids, they don't know what they want to do. So I try to treat it like you're applying to a college. You know, apply to those colleges, you know, kind of gauge how much those institutions cost to go, you know, come up with like a financial plan, your five-year goal, where do you see yourself in 5 years? And with each person I talk to, I try to like come up with a plan to work for them. And that's either if they play sports, how, you know, leadership in the military can help you grow. If you're playing in the orchestra, you know, that marching can help you with the military. If you're good at reading, you know, there's different jobs. There's like
the military bands are pretty prestigious, too.
Oh, yes, they are. Yes, they are.
They're very difficult to get into.
Mm-hmm. Yes, ma'am.
So maybe what was your story? You said you initially didn't think you wanted to serve. What changed your mind?
Well, I have family history. My grandfather was in the military. My dad was in the military. And ultimately, I didn't think I was going to join. I wanted to be an NBA basketball player, you know, aiming for the stars. I think reality hit me. I was 21, and I had a baby on the way. So for me, it came down to stability and setting a foundation for my family. And it was just one of those things where for me, I wanted something that was secure and stable and would give me that opportunity to be successful in the future.
No, that was the reason my dad joined many, many years ago. My older sister was on the way.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, because it provides an income, it provides health benefits for you, for your partner, for your children. It has that stability of structure there.
Yes, ma'am.
So what kept you in? Because now you've been in, I don't want to presume how old you are, but I feel like you've been in longer than your initial requirement.
Yes, ma'am. So my actual MOS is Military Police, 31 Bravo. I joined because I was going to college for criminal justice. I went to Ohio Dominican. And I did a 5-year contract, and I did something called the PAYS program, which kind of sets you up with a recruiter from local police departments so that when I'm about to get out of the Army, I have a job after the Army. When I came home on leave, I went to Columbus Police Academy. I went through the academy. In the Army, I went to SRT, Special Reaction Team, which is the equivalent to SWAT school. And I wanted to translate that and get out of the Army and do it. And for the Columbus Police Department, it's a little different. So it just wasn't matching at the time of what I wanted to do. And I was already a sergeant in the Army. So I think maybe I was still young, but I was looking at the differences and the comparisons and where I'd start off in the Columbus Police Department opposed to where I was in the Army. And for me at that time, staying in the Army was better for what I was trying to do in my life. And I reenlisted. And it's been the best decision I've made.
So you share that with recruits?
Yes,
when
ma'am.
You're talking with them, saying, look, I didn't know if it was going to be for me either.
Yes, ma'am.
I think that helps because it's easy to look at somebody in their 40s and think that they have it all figured out.
Yes, ma'am.
That they knew what they were going. And like, that's one of the things I even try to tell my kids. Like, I chose to go back to college at 25, completely changed what I was doing. I guess you could say I had a quarter life crisis. But the idea that we've got it all figured out at 18, 19, it can feel so overwhelming, right? I have to go to college. I have to spend now well over $100,000 to go to college sometimes. And I have to decide on something I'm going to do for the rest of my life. I mean, no pressure. That feels like such a huge decision to be making as a 18, 19-year-old.
Yes, ma'am.
And so do you ever say, like, hey, if you come join, they're, what is it, up to $27,000 a year for school on the GI Bill? Is that about what you get? I'm not exact. You don't have to have the exact number, but they can help you pay for college.
So what I try to do is I try to go over all their options. I try to, really figure out what they want to do. And even if they don't know what they want to do, I try to come up with some kind of plan. I went active duty, of course, but I do like talking about the reserves a lot more now.
Like the National Guard?
Not the National Guard, oh, okay. the Army Reserve.
Okay.
They're separate.
Sorry about that.
But in terms of how the National Guard or how the Army Reserve can help you pay for college, how if you go in the Army Reserve, it's not going to limit you to the state of Ohio. You can look at any city or any institution in the United States. I go over the different ways they're going to pay you. I go over, like, you know, just because you go in the reserve doesn't mean you're not in the Army. The job training. So if you pick a job that's transferable to the outside, I talk to a lot of applicants lately that want to be nurses. So I go over the Army practical nurse program and how you go to San Antonio, how you take the nursing exam in Texas, and how that would then transfer back to Ohio. You'd have to take it in Ohio, of course, but now you have that training, that job experience. And, you know, maybe that's going to set your foundation for what you can do after.
Yeah, and nursing school, if you want to be a doctor, those are not cheap professions to get into.
Yes, ma'am. I mean, the Army pays for it.
You know, one of the things in the Washington Post article that also struck me is the challenge in dealing with parents. Parents who may be nervous about their children joining the military, who may have reservations about the risks of serving overseas. How do you navigate parental reservations? Because ultimately, I mean, they're 18, they're adults, they can sign their own contracts, but I assume you want to get mom and dad on board.
Absolutely. I lead without my parent. I have a 16-year-old daughter that I was trying to talk into going to the Army Reserve. Just because I want her to get that experience. I want her to get that freedom. You can always protect your kids, and we always want to protect them. For me, I talk to a parent like I'd like someone to talk to myself. And I want to be honest with them. I don't want to sugarcoat things. You're going to have good days, you're going to have bad days. But, you know, as a parent, you want your kids to flourish. And it's just one of those things where if I explain what the Army can offer them, it's just I try to reassure that, you know, these things are, you know, there's dangers out there in the world, but you're not going to always be able to protect your kids. They're always going to be your kids. They're always going to love you. But, you know, they're going to go travel. They're going to do what they want to do. So I try to lead with that.
Do parents ever have reservations about combat? Do you hear those? I assume maybe after 9/11 you heard more of those concerns.
Yes, I definitely have.
I think it's scary for any parent.
I think it's scary for anybody. I think it's scary for a soldier. I think it's scary for everybody. I think it's just one of those things that it's a military, you know?
Yeah.
You can't tell someone if your kid joins the Army, you're not going to deploy, you know? That's something that's going to happen.
You hope we'll be in peace, but you can't promise it. My final question for you is, if somebody out there is considering, they're wavering, they're on the fence, maybe they have a child who's not sure what to do next, what would be your pitch, essentially?
I think I'm one of those people that I don't want to pressure you into joining. I want it to be something that you decide. So I feel like I try to build that relationship with you, and I legitimately care. So I want to know that the Army's the best decision for you. And yes, me being in the Army for a while, I see that I'm recruiting the next generation of soldiers. So I'm trying to set them up for success. So me telling them, like, you know, I did it. You know, I did it because I had a kid on the way. And you know what? I had another kid in the Army. So it's one of those things where, for me, it's been amazing. And it's given my abilities as a parent. I've matured because of the Army. You know, like, there's things that I would not have experienced or people I wouldn't have met if I didn't join the Army. So, like, I think I just go back to my experiences and I tell them, like, what I've been through, the good, the bad, and what I've grown from over the years.
That was Sergeant First Class Peter Van Dyne. Thank you for your service and your time this morning.
Thank you so much, ma'am.
Coming up, we're talking with a scholar who studies military recruitment. That's when All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
The candidates for November are set.
I know Donald Trump's tight.
Between now and Election Day.
We are not going back.
A campaign season unfolding faster.
Kamala Harris is not getting a promotion.
Than any in recent history.
Make America great again.
Follow it all with new episodes every weekday on the NPR Politics Podcast.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Anna Staver. We're talking this hour about the decline in recruitment for the military and armed forces. About 60% of Americans say they have confidence in the military, but that's the lowest percentage since 1997. Some of the challenges are longstanding, and Nora Ben-Shael is a professor of practice at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, where her work focuses on the future of warfare and military strategy. She's also the co-author of the book, Adaptation Under Fire, How Militaries Change in Wartime. Welcome to All Sides, Professor.
Thank you for having me.
We've been talking about challenges that the military is facing when it comes to meeting its recruitment goals. Things like declining birth rates, strong labor markets, and how more young people cannot pass the academic and physical requirements. But there's been challenges with recruiting in the past, and I wonder, as someone who studies this, how are these structural problems, or is this just cyclical?
It's a combination of both. The services, many of the services have had trouble recruiting over the past 2 years. The Army has fallen short about 30,000 soldiers over 2 years. The other services, a lesser number, mostly last year. This year, they all made their goals, but there's a good news and a bad news story there. Some of the reasons are good and appropriate, and it's due to the hard work of people like the sergeant you just spoke to. But in other cases, they've changed standards. They've, cut the goals that they were trying to get so that they would meet their numbers. So there's a lot going on. And again, it's both things that are happening right now and the effect of, you know, more cyclical changes in the job market and such.
You know, one of the things that we haven't talked about yet that I find fascinating is the declining birth rate, because, you know, millennials were a large generation. We're now the largest living generation, but we're also having a lot less children. So going forward, just structurally, there will just be a smaller pool of people to choose from.
That's right. The denominator is shrinking. In fact, the military has estimated that there will be a 10% shrink in the population of college-aged young people by 2026. And the reasons are interesting, right? That's because the college age is sort of 18 to 22. That's 18 to 22 years after the 2008 financial crisis. So fewer people had kids. That has generational effects. So the denominator is shrinking. The problem is, how do you, out of a shrinking pool of people, how do you continue to find more and more qualified people when, as you heard before, so few people meet the entrance standards? Only 23% of young Americans can meet the military's entrance standards.
I want to talk about those standards and whether it's time to rethink some of them, because one of the ones I find really fascinating is this prohibition on certain types of medication. Now, obviously, if you have asthma, there could be a legitimate physical question about your ability to serve. But ADHD medication really struck me as particularly interesting because you can't be on it. You have to get off it for a certain period of time. But if you make it through recruitment, they can put you back on it once you're serving.
Yeah, the military is extremely reluctant to change standards because a lot of standards are there for good reason. And people, criticize the military for getting too easy if they change some of the standards. But you're right. I think that a lot of the standards do need to be looked at. And you've picked my favorite one to point out, right, which is mental health medication. My own view, and I've published on this, is that the qualifications to enter the military should be the same as the qualifications to be in the military, to stay in the military. If you develop depression or ADHD or something like that while you're already wearing a uniform, you can stay in the military and be treated for it. It just doesn't make a lot of logical sense to exclude people from coming in on what we know are treatable and manageable conditions while they're serving.
The other one that is, I think, a little more complicated is marijuana. Half of the states in the nation have now legalized it recreationally. A majority of states have legalized it for medical use. But federal law still classifies it as a Schedule I drug, which means worst of the worst, absolutely not. And obviously the military is tied by federal law. But I don't know. I wonder when we're going to hit a tipping point on that, because you can drink alcohol, you can smoke cigarettes and serve.
So I think everybody in the military and around the military agrees that you need to have a drug-free force.
Sure.
You want people in the military who are not taking mind-altering substances, that are prohibited. What we're seeing, though, is that examples of past marijuana use are keeping people from being able to enter the military. And particularly if you test positive for marijuana in your entry exams before you get to basic training, that can disqualify you. The Air Force has actually, one of the ways it met its numbers this year was it ran a pilot where if you failed the marijuana test, At the time of entry, you essentially got a waiver. You had to retake it in 90 days. And if you passed that test, you were allowed to enter. Again, some people will criticize the military for being more lenient about marijuana use, but I think, the goal should be having a force that is drug-free, that doesn't automatically need to start, long before someone chooses to enter the military.
And the other complication with that is that the testing for THC, right? You can test positive 30 days after you've used. You can be stone cold sober for several weeks and still test positive.
Yeah, and that's exactly why the Air Force is piloting this program. Partly it needed to make its numbers, frankly. They loosened quite a number of standards. But this one they did in pilot test, and it'll be interesting to see. Again, you have to be able to pass a clean drug test before you put on a uniform and actually join the military. But in that period of entry training, they have given some waivers. And that might be a way forward for the other services. They'll be watching carefully to see what that pilot reveals.
Yeah, we talked a little bit about the Army's piloting program towards ESL and helping those here on permanent residency, those people seeking paths to residency, one of which is military service, and getting them up to the English language standards. I find that one really fascinating because when we talk about jobs and the economy, a lot of times we are talking about immigrants that are filling those job holes in the economy.
Well, again, the Army has been facing what has really been a devastating recruiting crisis for the past 3 years. Again, they made their numbers this year. When we say year, the government fiscal year ends on September 30th. So we're talking, that's the sense in which we're talking about the past year gone by. The Army did meet its numbers. But one of the things that it did, first of all, it cut the numbers it needed because it had shrunk the force based on the poor recruiting of the past 2 years. But they also piloted a few years ago something that they have since greatly expanded that prepares recruits for coming into basic training. If a potential recruit falls short of either the educational standards, you were talking about the ASVAB scores previously with the sergeant, or if they fall short of the physical standards, the Army now has centralized programs on the same bases that do boot camp, although they're not in its parallel, it's not the same thing. That gives folks up to 6 weeks of remedial instruction, test preparation, works with them to meet the academic scores on the ASVAB, or to build up their physical fitness tests. That pilot that they started 3 years ago has gone so well that the Army is now getting a quarter of its new recruits through that program from someone who meets all the under standards but falls just short on either the physical or academic standards. It's gone so well that all of the other services have now copied that. And so that's another way that, the Army is seeking to make its numbers without necessarily changing its standards, but helping people get to them.
I want to take a call from Bill in Columbus. Bill, welcome to All Sides.
Thank you.
I understand you did serve in the military in the U.S. Army.
I did. From 61 through 64.
And you were in the band, is that correct?
I was in the Army band, correct. I went through basic in Fort Jackson and had no problems there. In high school, I ran track, played football, so the physical part of it was very easy. The difficult part was when they told me I'd have to, and this is Clearwater, Florida, that I grew up in, that I would have to go to Atlanta for my audition to get into the music part of the Army. And my dad, of course, being an Army person himself in World War II, we drove all night long, waited up there, and I did my test, my theory test, my sound test, my trombone is what I was going in for, and passed everything. So when I got back, then I went in October and did my basic, went to AIT, which is just assigned to a band there in Fort Jackson. And then I was sent to Germany. Well, it never happened because I ended up on a boat or a ship, and it went down to Guantanamo Bay, and we evacuated 2,000 women and children and came back to South Carolina, or I think it was Norfolk, Virginia. and they didn't know what to do with me, so they finally rerouted me and gave me orders to the Republic of Panama, to the Canal Zone.
Probably sounds like you really thing. Got to go everywhere.
Oh, I did. When I was in Panama in the Canal Zone for 2 years, we had a great band director, and so me being a singer too, I got talked him into organizing a chorus. So 8 members of the band, of course, back in those days it was all male, so it was an all male chorus.
Oh, that's really cool, Bill. Unfortunately, we've got to move on. But you know, one of the things I find really fascinating about his story, Nora, is that you don't think about it, but if you're really a talented musician, the military bands are really prestigious.
They are. Their numbers have shrunk in recent years because the force itself, the U.S. military, is at one of the active duty forces at one of its smallest sizes in decades. And so every person that you have in uniform, you know, the push has been to make more and more of the people who are in uniform part of the fighting force.
Mm.
But bands are important for morale, for tradition, so they do still exist, of course.
I want to ask, you know, it's still maybe too soon to know how COVID has impacted military recruiting, but I wonder if you have any theories, because particularly when it comes to the academics, we hear a lot in education about the decline in academic performance because of the pandemic.
Yeah, I think that's unquestionable. You're seeing teachers at all levels. I teach graduate students at Johns Hopkins SAIS, and we're starting to see even in the graduate student population a little bit less proficiency in writing from some of those missed years. So that is definitely a factor. Recruiters lost access to schools. You heard about all the efforts that the sergeant, you know, does in the community to reach out to people. Most of those things and activities were closed. And so you don't just build that back up in a year. Those kinds of connections and human connections take a really long time to rebuild. I think maybe that you know, the recruiter's hard work has overcome some of that now. But there are lots of other things in terms of shaping how young people view their lives, what they're interested in pursuing. You know, part of the problem for people like me who want to figure out what's causing things is that so many things happened around the same time with COVID that it's very hard to piece out what has actually caused the recruiting crisis and now that rebound a bit. And that also, that 2020 period also was a time of great polarization and politicization of the military. You talked about that in the declining confidence numbers, which have dropped sharply. Again, they're, as you pointed out rightly, they're better than most other institutions, but they're down, depending on the surveys, between 20% and 30% in 3 to 4 years. So that's very troubling. So a lot of things happened around the same time. And so some of it is the pandemic cause, some of it is other things. That politicization has had a huge effect on potential recruiting. And it's hard to figure out, you know, how much is which.
Yeah, when it comes to political polarization, I think it's across the board. Like I said, you look at approval numbers for Congress, for government, for the U.S. Supreme Court, for military, for all public institutions, public schools and education. Trust is down everywhere. It feels like we don't trust anyone anymore, which is sad and probably a conversation for another day. But, you know, I think it is hard. And that was the headline of the Washington Post article, like selling America. How do you sell defending America when people don't trust most of its institutions?
Well, that's a huge question. And I wish I could answer that and solve what I think
I know.
You know, probably the biggest challenge facing our country at the moment. Unfortunately, the military has, politicians from both sides have used the military to serve their own domestic purposes. It's happened among Democrats and the left, but I'm not saying this as a partisan, I'm saying this as an analyst. The Republican Party, and particularly Republican members of Congress, have created a narrative that the military is too woke to be effective. It's not true. All of the service chiefs have testified to that. They complain that there's too much training in diversity, but in fact, there's actually only about an hour and a half a year is devoted to that. But that narrative helps, you know, motivate people with a particular point of view, and recruiting among people who, among young white men, has declined more dramatically than for other subgroups. And I think there's a relationship there between the political narrative and the consequences for the military. So, some of this, much of this politicization, the military is not bringing on itself, but our politicians are using the military, which is and must remain politically neutral for their own ends. And I find that, is having a tremendously devastating effect on the military and on the ability of the nation to provide for its own security.
Yeah, the idea that serving in the military might say something about your politics.
Yeah, and the other side, on the Democratic side, a lot of Democratic politicians have played up the narrative that you'll be killed or harmed if you join the military, when statistically, as your recruiter said, of course it's possible, but it's statistically quite unlikely. So yeah, as I said, it is both sides, although the narrative of wokeism seems to have had quite a direct relationship with the recruiting crisis.
That was Professor Nora Ben-Shael. She's a professor of John Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies. Thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome.
And thank you all for listening to All Sides on 89.7 NPR News.